Genesis 32, 22 through 32, which you read before you came in here today, gives a strange account of Jacob in his wrestling match with God through the night. And I think as we get into this, the first thing to note and what is foremost in this story is that this was terrifying. Sometimes we think this was messing around. You know how a big brother used to come and put you in a headlock and give you the knobby and that type of thing? This is terrifying. Terrifying in the fact that the Lord became something entirely different than anything Jacob had known before. At this point, at least, we can see the Lord was really not wrestling with Jacob to have a good time. Jacob was God's opponent. And throughout the course of Jacob's life, we see him having multiple enemies, and particularly Laban was one. And Jacob's anticipating his older brother Esau as an enemy, and he's completely frightened by him. He's almost paralyzed by fear. And as we're going to get into it a little bit further in the reading, he actually starts sending his livestock, and he starts sending his servants, and he starts sending his family ahead of himself. He's so afraid that maybe by the time they get done with them, I can be on the run. He's scared to death. But the Lord is an enemy? God was no enemy to Jacob. I think one can actually make the argument that Jacob viewed God as simply friendly. Almost a benign figure whom Jacob could manipulate because he's Jacob the deceiver. And maybe he could turn in what God could provide it to him as an advantage in his life when things got difficult. And I wonder how many of us view God the same way at times in our life. He's a convenience to get us through this season. He's a pain reliever. And when that pain goes away, we kind of push him away too. You see, the Lord is the great physician. He's the great healer of our souls. He's the provider. He's our resting place. He's our righteousness. He's our strong tower. He's our victory. He sent his only son to die for us. All that is true, and we want to embrace that, and we want to love that, and we want that in our lives. But if that's the only way we see God, we don't see God clearly through an accurate lens. Because without a healthy fear of God, we can wrongly assume God is more for us than he is for himself. And I know this may sound weird, but this is a great truth we all need to know in our lives. God is more passionate for his glory than for our glory. God is more passionate for his glory than he is for our glory. And like Jacob, we often use God for our own gain in life and in our own wants. But now in his wrestling with God, Jacob finally realizes that God cannot be used for his means. He discovered, and quite suddenly, that the Lord is to be feared. And it's kind of like Aslan in the Chronicles of Narnia. He's terrible, and he's lovely. And perhaps this incident proved in the life of Jacob a true understanding for the first time that God is God, and that Jacob is just simply a child of the Most High. Jacob is shown to be profoundly changed in his life from that moment on. So much so that they changed his name from Jacob the deceiver to Israel, one who struggles with God and has come through. You see, before the wrestling match, life circumstances had reduced Jacob to helplessness. Did you have that sense yesterday when we were talking? He was a bargaining chip in this family. Go sleep with that person. Okay. Go do this. Okay. And I'm thinking, where's your identity? Where's an understanding of who you are? Where's your grasp of the promise that has been entrusted to you? And you're going back and forth and throwing around and just looking for the immediate pleasures of life. Don't you understand who you are? And I think the answer was no, he didn't. He was in this helpless cycle of, I just need to react to life circumstances. Well, he needed God to intervene in his life. The 11th hour had arrived, and God had not delivered him yet. It was a crisis of faith, and Jacob was at his wit's end. Have you been there before? Have you been in a moment where you go, I don't know what to do? I don't know where to go. I don't know who else to contact. And some things may have been out of your control, and life just seems to be spiraling. And there may be other times where it was your choices that put you into that situation. And they may have been hidden secrets, and now they're being revealed. And all the doors that you would use to escape have now been closed. The 11th hour is at hand. And hope seems lost. But that's when God enters into the mess of our lives. We find in Genesis 32 that this man, who is the pre-incarnate Christ, wrestled with Jacob and not the other way around. We have to realize by this passage that the Lord was the instigator of this wrestling match. Jacob, no doubt, was not in the right frame of mind to wrestle. And I love what James Montgomery Boyce states about this. Listen carefully. He says, it is not that Jacob was seeking God so earnestly that when God, as it were, got close to him, he grappled with him and refused to let him go until he blessed him. It is true that Jacob later begged for a blessing. But at the beginning, it is not Jacob who seeks God to wrestle with him. Rather, it is God who comes to wrestle with Jacob to bring him to a point of both physical and spiritual submission. My friends, the Lord is not a God to be manipulated, but he is a God to be worshiped. A.W. Pink writes this, Jacob was not wrestling with this man to obtain a blessing. Instead, the man was wrestling with Jacob to gain some object from him. As to what this object is, the best of the commentators agree, it was to reduce Jacob to a sense of nothingness, to cause him to see what a poor, helpless, and worthless creature he was. It was to teach us through him that all-important lesson that in recognized weakness lies our greatest strength. That's one of the main points we see in this wrestling with God. Weakness is broken into submission, and once we find that place of submission is actually where we find that place of strength. Submission to God's leading, submission to God's control in our lives, realizing that there's nothing stronger or more determinant than that. The Lord of the universe, the one whose handiwork formed the heavens and the starry host, he is perfect in every way. He does no wrong. Regardless of how we see the circumstances played out in our life, he does no wrong. Regardless if we're injured deeply, he does no wrong. He alone is the sovereign Lord, and he alone has his will done, and it will be accomplished. Guys, you need to realize, and I need to realize, God will always win the wrestling matches of our life. God wins every wrestling match of our lives. And if we're smart, then the sooner we submit, the better off we're going to be. You see, this is the upside-down kingdom, where the poor is rich. To mourn is to be comforted. And we see the profound reality of the gospel in Genesis' account of this wrestling match. Having come into contact face to face with the Lord of hosts, with the ever patient and faithful one, we see at long last a broken and contrite man who is absolutely humbled to the core. Have you ever been to that spot? Have you ever experienced that place of brokenness where there's nowhere else to go and you find God completely sufficient because there's nothing else. In 2007, I took a job in Elk River, Minnesota, and I left Autumn Ridge. We were Autumn Ridge at that point for 2 years. And what I realized, I was escaping from something. I wasn't being called, but it sure sounded good that I was being called. And I got there, and God took me through a wilderness experience that broke me to the core. Everything that I thought I was, what I realized was that God in my life, that security God, not security guard, that security God in my life was recognition. And I had to wrestle with God as I saw my family suffering due to my pride. And when I had nowhere else to go, and when I cried out, he was absolutely faithful. And one of the best phone calls I've ever received in my life is, "Hello, Dan, John Steer here. How would the prodigal like to come back home?" Remember? Claire said, "What'd you tell him?" And I said, "I don't think I let him finish the sentence." "Yeah, we'll be there." I tell you, I never wish to go through that again, but I'm so thankful I did. In weakness, we find our strength, and our strength is in him. And he carries us. We see a man in Jacob who's dependent upon God rather than dependent upon himself. We see in Jacob a picture of a man renewed, restored, redeemed by the power of God. He's remade now in God's image, finally surrendered to the will of God in his life, and we see no small measure of great faith that's been worked out. This is absolutely beautiful to behold. And it's something we all must surrender to. You see, to find our lives, we have to lose them, guys. To find the life that God has given us, we have to lose this life that we perceive we need. But let's be real, the prospect of wrestling with God is not all that pleasant. Sooner or later, God comes after us aggressively, just like he did to Jacob on that dark night. And if Jacob's wrestling with God is any model for our own, and it surely is, for a while we wrestle to get free of God. And then you realize, I don't want him to go away, and we wrestle to stay attached to God. We push him away. "No, no, 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 this is what I need." And then we experience him and we go, "Please don't ever, ever leave me because you're all that I have." This is great theory, but it's not fun. God will wound us if he must till we fight him no longer. God will wound us if he must till we fight him no longer. And then from the deep within us, we give voice to that same yearning Jacob uttered, which is, "God, I will not let you go unless you bless me." And finally, after what seems like a lifetime of striving with God and man, we receive that blessing. Jacob named the site of his wrestling Peniel, which means the face of God. Because as he said, "I saw God face to face and my life was delivered." You see, he didn't mean that despite seeing God up close and personal, he lived, but rather because of seeing God's face, his life was saved. And it wasn't the physical face of the other wrestler that he meant. Jacob saw the shining face of God's blessing in his life, spoken of in that great blessing of number 6. Listen. "The Lord bless you and keep you." That's the promise, right? That we've been talking about from the very beginning, the covenant. "The Lord bless you and keep you." Now listen to the second part, because this ties it all together. "May his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you." The narrator of this story says in verse 31, the sun rose above him like the face of God as he passed Peniel, which means the face of God, and he was limping because of his hip. Again, none of us like to wrestle with God, to be forced by Almighty to face who we are, to be who we really are like. To be wounded till we surrender to him, but sometimes that's the only way that God can bless us. And we have to stop doing life our way and we have to trust him. But then what do we do? What happens the next day? What lies ahead once we've struggled with God and God has struggled with us until we've both lost the battle and won the war? And the next chapter in Jacob's story is Genesis 33, and it illustrates what it is to like to walk under the sunshine of God's blessed smile. So the terrifying prospect that arose in Act 1 of this drama is now upon Jacob in the first verse of Genesis 33. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, and he was coming with 400 men. So the night before, they're at the River Jabbok at the north ford of that. That's Peniel. And Jacob has all his household, he has all his livestock, he has his families and his servants, and he sends them across the River Jabbok. And now it's just him and God, and they wrestle that night. And now Jacob, who is now Israel, he's no longer Jacob the deceiver, he's Israel, looks up and he sees Esau with 400 men coming at him. The moment of truth. Moment of truth for me in Elk River was when my wife had tears streaming down her eyes and she said, "What have you done to us?" And there was nowhere else to go except to cry out to my Lord, to ask for forgiveness, to commit our lives to him, not knowing what the next day brought. But here's what I'll tell you what happened is God speaks in amazing ways, because we were so downcast and so literally depressed. We were going to pray for our meal one night, and my wife and I couldn't utter a word out of our mouths. And our 10-year-old boy, Will Dan Farm, says, "I'll pray." And he says, "God, I don't know where you're going to take us, but we're going to trust you wherever you take us. But we sure would like to go back to Rochester. Thanks for the food." And he looks up and we're bawling. He's like, "What?" That's Peniel. That's the face of God speaking through a little boy. That's grace. He looks up and here's Esau with 400 men. When Jacob had last seen Esau, it was 20 years earlier. And what was Esau's demeanor at that point? "I'm going to kill you." Now 400 men he's bringing with him with sufficient proof that Esau probably was still holding on to that grudge. Knowing this, Jacob puts his clan in order and he starts sending them forward. Pretty amazing story. So Jacob does something unthinkable, though. Guess what he does? He sees the 401 men alone, and he runs to the front. Runs to the front of his family. He's no longer Jacob the deceiver, Jacob the schemer, Jacob the one who's looking for an out. He says, "I'm going before my family, and I'm going to face him." They've already sent livestock ahead, but before his family, he runs to the front. That's what God can do for us. God's grace gives us faith to face our fears. And I don't mean God's grace gives us the power of positive thinking, this grinning optimism, or this good feeling that things are going to work out. I mean God's grace gives us faith in the God who saves us. Jacob prayed to God in chapter 32, verse 11, "Save me from the hand of my brother." And after his night of wrestling with God, he said in chapter 32, 30, it is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. When he goes out to face Esau, then, he's confident that God has already saved him. And that's where that hymn comes from, is whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. My friends, we all face terrors and anxieties, and we've all learned that trusting God is not easy. And if we're honest, putting our fears into God's hand is sometimes like trying to tuck an octopus into bed, right? But rather than focusing on our fears and our prayers, we ought to focus on our God. Someone once said, instead of telling God about the storms, maybe it's time we start telling the storms about our God. To think well about God, we need our Bibles, we need to read the Psalms, we need to read the stories of Jesus, the great truths of our faith that's found in the epistles. We need to read Isaiah's words of comfort. In those moments of fear, we need to take the Bible and we need to work the Bible's truth like salve into a wound, because it brings healing and restoration. Once our eyes are fixed on Jesus, then we can tell him every single angle on our fear or our problem that we can identify. Philippians 4:6 says, don't be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. When you're looking fear in the face, guys, take time to truly thank God. The first thought is, how do I get out of here? We don't have to choose that. We can choose to praise. We can choose to hold to the promise that he is the one who has already saved us. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard our hearts and our minds in Christ Jesus. You see, one of the wonders of God's grace is how God can give us peace in the face of absolutely terrifying experiences. Ours isn't a faith that believes nothing bad will ever happen. Jesus said, in this world, you will have trouble. If you're not now, you will. It's a guarantee. In this world, we will have trouble. But I have overcome the world. Nothing can harm us if God has already saved us. Last November, as my mom was in her last days of her life, I had the privilege of spending a lot of time with her, and we both knew the end was drawing near. And we were sharing a lot of time together, and she shared that she absolutely trusted Jesus, but she was scared to death of the unknown. She says, I'm not afraid of the other side. I'm afraid of what's going to happen before I get to the other side. I get that. That's legit. And at her bedside, a few days before she died, I read the story from Mark 4 about the storm at sea. The one where the disciples were terrified that they would die and Jesus was sleeping in the back of the boat. And when in their panic they woke Jesus, he rebuked the sea till it lay still, and then he rebuked them for a little faith. Not because they didn't still the sea themselves, but because they didn't believe that they were safe as long as they were in his presence. And I told Mom that night that it is a miracle indeed when God delivers somebody from a deadly situation. But I said, Mom, I think it's even a greater work when he gives his people peace, no matter what the outcome is going to be. I can rest in his arms. My mom died a few days later after our time together. And it's been 7 months now, and I miss her terribly. A lot of you guys know this, where you pick up the phone and you go, oh yeah, they're not there. I want to share what I wrote in my journal. I wrote, this is hard. I struggle with reaching out to God in the midst of sadness, in the midst of such disappointment. I really just want to be sad and want him to show up at my door and comfort me. I want to see his face now and not have to look forward to the future. it seems like it would be so much easier. But I guess that's why it is the hard things in life that build our faith. And then I wrote Psalm 145, 17 and 18. The Lord is righteous in all his ways and loving towards all he has made. The Lord is near those who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. You see, he gives his people peace no matter what the outcome, and that's exactly what's happening in Jacob as alone he walks by God's grace to meet Esau and the 400 men. And as you know, what happens next is a complete stunner. The surprising ending that if you didn't already know it, you would be weeping as you heard about it. When Jacob spots Esau from hundreds of yards away, Jacob begins to make his way towards his brother, and he's bowing every so often as he's making this route. And it says that he bowed seven times. All the while, 400 men are watching with their hands working their handles of their swords as they're seeing him come. Behind Jacob is his family. Mothers hush their kids and put heavy hands on their boys' shoulders. You can feel the air is still and heavy and hot. And then the ending of note that no one expected, verse 4, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and he embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and he kissed him and they wept. And the next verses just drip with grace. Then Esau looked up and he saw the woman and his children and he said, "Who are these with you?" And Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." And then the maidservants and their children approached, and they bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came, and they bowed down. And then last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they bowed down. Esau asks, "What's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met to find favor in your eyes, my lord?" he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob. "If I found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. Please accept this present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I needed." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted. But here's the lesson. Once we've surrendered to God and received his blessing, God's grace runs to embrace us. God's grace fills life with surprises that are undeserved, unearned, unexpected gifts of eye-popping proportions. Jacob and Esau had a nitroglycerin-type relationship. Hatred from Esau, fear from Jacob, that was set up for an explosion. That was a perfect storm. But God miraculously neutralized both of those forces. God's grace is the wonder drug for relationships. And we know how God's grace changed Jacob, but we don't know how it was that God changed Esau. I suppose Esau might have brought 400 men for him for protection, but I doubt it. I think when he left home, he was fuming. I think when he left home, he had a focus and a goal in mind of what he was going to do with those 400 men. And he had 20 years of revenge and resentment and regret boiling up in him. But somehow in answer to Jacob's prayer and in an act of grace towards Esau as much as Jacob, God transformed Esau's heart, leaving those 400 men standing there looking at each other saying, "What do we do now?" You see, God shows his might most vividly when grace changes hearts. God does a lot of supernatural things, guys. He spoke creation into place. He holds the sun still. He multiplied bread. He walked on water. But I'll tell you what, I think that's all kid stuff compared to what God does when he changes a heart like he did here. And God will do that in our lives. To us and even to those whom we fear. Our faith in Christ Jesus has brought us the gift of the Holy Spirit, and the Spirit changes who we are and how we respond to life. Grace also humbles us without crushing us. And there's a strange thing hidden between the lines of this story. God had told these these boys' mothers that Esau would serve Jacob. And when Isaac blessed Jacob, he said the same thing. And what they were saying is that in this life, you know what's going to happen? Esau is going to bow down to Jacob. Yet what did we just witness? Here's Jacob bowing down seven times as he approached Esau. By the way, bowing down seven times is what a normal person would do when they came upon a king. Now, some may see fawning fear in that. I don't. You know what I see? I see grace. I see a man humbled by God. I see a man willing to bow so that he might be reconciled. I see a man who has become a servant, but he's not a doormat. A man beautifully, righteously humble enough to bow to his brother as he would to a king. You see, grace heals inflamed memories. These guys had a history. They wrestled in the womb. There was a lot of painful memories of the past here. A lot of you have painful memories of the past. Vengeful, fearful, they were carrying this encounter like burning arrows, and memories are like that. They're dangerous and they're toxic. But somehow these two brothers who had fought even in the womb are suddenly hugging, and they're weeping, and they're making introductions, and they're giving gifts to one another. You see, one of the things they didn't do is they didn't talk about the past. Sometimes we feel like we need to let all the air out, that we need to list all our grievances, and sometimes we do. But not always. Sometimes it's better to cover the past with a blanket of grace. When God has given both parties the ability to do so, let grace abound. And that's what God does when we give him room to work with grace. God's grace is at work in us, and it releases God's blessing. The translation of verse 11 in the NIV is unfortunate. It says, please accept this present that was brought to you. The Hebrew word is blessing. Please accept my blessing that was brought to you. What is Jacob saying? The blessing that I received? May God bless you. It's what he connived to steal from Esau in the first place, and now he's blessing his brother. Having been a recipient of God's grace and Esau's, Jacob now turns God's blessing back to work as an extravagant gift. And can I challenge you? You are agents of God's grace. There are situations in your life, there are painful memories, there are conflicts. And you've been wrestling with God over this for a long time. I want to encourage you to take the route of Israel, to take the lead, to be an agent of grace. That if you need to bow down, bow down. Verse 10, Jacob says, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you've received me favorably. The face of God is the name he gave the place he spent the night with. He'd just seen God's face. So what does it mean when he says this? He doesn't mean that Esau looked like God to him. He's saying that when he looked at Esau, he saw a face tear-stained and soft and welcoming. When he saw the face of Esau, he saw somebody restored and forgiving. He saw the face of God's grace. He saw God's grace at work before his eyes. In other words, grace is the face of God. When Jacob met, what he meant was to look at you is like looking God's grace in the face. Wouldn't you like to experience something like that? You know, Jesus told of a prodigal son not too different from Jacob, not too different from us, who also trudged home in fear. The son saw his father running toward him, just as Esau had run toward Jacob. The prodigal was stunned to be embraced, just as Jacob had been stunned. In fact, Jesus used words almost identical to the words used in this account of Jacob and Esau. In the grace of the father who ran to welcome and honor his prodigal son, we see the face of God. And we have seen the face of God in Jesus when we bowed before him and we found him, and he embraced us. And he forgave us. And he just loves us. Church, when I see your face, I want to see the face of God. I want you to see the face of God in my face. So what's happened this week? Has Fort Wilderness been Peniel to some of you? Has it been a place where you've come to wrestle with God and you've experienced his grace and you've come to understand his love for you and his commitment to you and his faithfulness to you? And you go, what can I do with something like this? How can I act out? Pastor John gave a wonderful opportunity for some of you who have never been baptized. You may have been sitting here for decades going, I'm wrestling with this idea of being baptized. It's not an option. It's obedience. I hear God and I will obey. I'm no longer going to wrestle with this. I'm not pushing back on this anymore. I'm holding on and I'm going to follow through. And I want to challenge you. Maybe this is your Peniel right here. This is the landmark for you. This is Bethel. This is the house of God. This is the place where he met you and gave you that vision. And it was a crossroads moment in your life. And there's no better way to make that a landmark than to go through the waters of baptism in that lake. I want to challenge you with that. But the last thing I want to challenge you with as you go into your small groups today is I want you to talk about being the face of God. I want you to talk about what does it mean for me to act in grace? Or where have you seen the face of God through someone else in your life? May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon each and every one of you and be gracious unto you. You are dismissed.